Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, November 20th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, alongside my beloved colleague and co-host. Let me start there.
Yes.
Because today we're talking about workplace stuff that doesn't go so well.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily personal friction, but just sort of general issues that we have with workplace culture, right? So performance reviews, too many emails, not enough emails, too many meetings, not enough meetings.
Reply all
emails. Just talking about work culture and some of the things that bug us about work culture with a couple of experts who can answer your questions. So if you have horror stories or you have things about work culture that really bug you, you call in, you write in, and we will address them on the show today. Tell us your workplace horror stories. What drives you nuts? What should bosses change? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment or a long rambling story in the chat.
I look forward to those stories because this is really, I think, going to be a listener-driven show.
Yes.
So we look forward to hearing from you. And, you know, generational issues. There's all sorts of things we can talk about today. And
can I give you an issue?
Yeah, give me an issue.
LinkedIn.
Oh, what about it?
What is it?
Oh,
what's
I'm
going
LinkedIn.
On there?
Yeah.
Every week I get an email from LinkedIn claiming that I'm, quote unquote, on a roll on LinkedIn.
You're like, I'm not even on there.
I'm not even there. How could I be on a roll? What's happening on LinkedIn? Do I need to be on LinkedIn?
Yeah,
is that
I think
like integral
so.
Now
like,
to work culture?
That's actually like to me a pure workplace social media platform. So,
what do you do on there?
I just post. It's like all about work and accomplishments and stuff. It's not like Facebook. People don't share family pictures or anything. It's all work.
That sounds horrible. Why would I want to be?
But I mean, you know, and it's like it's where you actually make connections for work and jobs and all kinds of stuff.
I got all the connections I need because I'm connected to
that's
you.
That's right. And by the way, today is also DJ of the day because it's Thursday.
Yes.
Which means you get to email in your song picks that relate to workplace. Do not pick Dolly Parton's 9 to 5. Okay, that's the only
Don't do it.
Be more creative.
Stop
people
sending us 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton. We love Dolly Parton.
We do.
We even like that song.
Yes.
Stop sending it.
But don't do it. So you have to email studio2@whyy.org by 12:30 today.
Yes.
And who's going to be picking today?
I guess Kevin.
Kevin. EP Kevin will be picking. And so become our DJ of the day.
Yeah, so songs about work, workplace, whatever, bosses, but just not 9 to 5. That's all.
That's all.
All right, trio of local news stories. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, since we're talking about work, yeah, Pennsylvania is set to become the 28th state to pass the Crown Act. The bill was originally introduced back in 2019. It jumped its final hurdle, passing with overwhelming support in the Pennsylvania Senate, and it is now on the governor's desk. If you do not know what it is, the Crown Act, Crown stands for Creating a Respectful Open World for Natural Hair, and is specifically aimed at stopping race-based hair discrimination in workplaces and in schools. The Pennsylvania Crown Act would basically amend the Pennsylvania Human Relations Act to protect hair textures and ethnic hairstyles. This is a big win for Pennsylvania House Speaker Joanna McClinton. She was an original co-sponsor of the bill back in 2019. She introduced it along with lead sponsor Representative Latasha Mays. And for all my curly, bushy, coily-headed people, today is a really good day. You can wear your locks, your braids, your twists, your afro, bantu knots, and cornrows. I wear cornrows. And I have to say, Avi, like literally when I graduated law school, you had to basically straighten your hair in order to get a job. That's what they told us. You know, the recruiters, you know, the trainers at my law school was like, you need to change your hair. You need to be ready. But now you could do what you want. And now it's codified in law.
As long as your boss follows the law.
Yeah. As long as your boss follows the law. By the way, it does not stop workplaces from setting rules for safety or health reasons.
Right.
But it has to apply to everyone and not to certain people because of their hairstyle.
Yeah. Crown Act, by the way, an amazing acronym.
Yeah, it is.
Very good acronym for a law. So whoever came up with that, tip of the hat to you. It's interesting you mentioned that the bill passed overwhelmingly in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unlikely that between, you know, 2019 and now a bunch of people were suddenly convinced. But you know the way these things work. Oftentimes, like, there's bartering that goes on. Like, we won't bring this bill up for a vote unless we get this, blah, blah, blah. So it seems to me, based on how overwhelming the vote was in favor of the Crown Act, that perhaps there had been the votes for this in the past, but today is the day that it finally gets through.
But it's going to save a lot of people money and time sitting in, you know, the hairstylist chair. So thank you, whoever did it.
All right.
It's passed.
From crowns to monarchs.
Ooh,
now.
I like that transition.
There has been a breakthrough in the tracking of monarch butterflies, mm-hmm. thanks to a company located in Cape May, New Jersey, Jersey Shore. This story comes to us from Ye Old Times of New York. The company is called Cellular Tracking Technologies. They have developed a way to track individual monarch butterflies, which travel all over North America on these epic migratory journeys. Mm-hmm. And this tracking could lead to major breakthroughs and already has led to a lot of insights about how the monarch butterflies get from Canada to Mexico and back. The breakthrough is because of teeny tiny
little eeny weensy
solar powered trackers that this company in Cape May has developed. They've been attached to 400 butterflies, and the scientists can follow these butterflies now on their phone.
Wow.
On an app.
Wow.
And in fact, you can do the same. There's a free app. I just downloaded it called Project Monarch Science. And mm-hmm. I was tracking some butterflies just a moment ago.
That's pretty cool. I have to say, this technology is really, really cool. These trackers are itsy bitsy. They cost $200 a pop.
Yeah.
I mean, and because the technology is so condensed. And according to the New York Times, each tag-bearing butterfly making this journey is by weight. If you compare it, it's the equivalent to a half raisin carrying 3 uncooked grains of rice. That's how these little things, they're so small.
It's a good visual there.
Yeah. And this is just amazing what technology can do. And by the way, these butterflies, their population had decreased by more than 20% over the years.
That's why this is necessary.
And so this is really necessary to turn the tides.
Yeah. And we hope it's going to lead to insights into how to save monarch butterflies, but also bees and other flying insects.
Yeah. This technology is a huge breakthrough.
Yeah.
So,
and by the way, I was just tracking a butterfly, and this mm-hmm. is super cool. Like, so the butterfly was near Cape May, actually, coincidentally. And then it crossed over to Lewis, Delaware, like the same path as the ferry. And now it's making its way down the Delmarva Peninsula. It's getting close to Ocean City, Maryland. I guess eventually we'll make its way
to Mexico. I gotta download the app now. You're making me want to download the app.
You're like, go, butterfly, go. It's fun. And it's good science.
It's good science. Third story.
Now to a queen of the diamond.
Yes. Philadelphia's own Monet Davis is set to make history tonight as she is drafted. Let me start over. Philadelphia's own Monet Davis is set to make history tonight as she is drafted into the most promising women's professional baseball league to be launched in the United States in decades. Yes, 24-year-old Davis will be the face of the Women's Pro Baseball League. This is the first effort to organize pro baseball for women since the 1940s and 50s.
League of their own.
Yeah, according to Sports Illustrated. By the way, they did a whole write-up on Davis that dropped this week. And if you recall, back in 2014, Monet Davis became the first girl ever to pitch a shutout at the Little League World Series. She set the world on fire. She was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. She wrote a memoir. She went to the White House. She was on the night shows.
She was it.
She was the it girl. Then she kind of grew up, you know, and she kept playing baseball. She switched to basketball. Then she went to college at Hampton, where she played softball, but she didn't really like softball. She got a master's degree. Now she's 24. But then when she heard about this new league, she couldn't stop thinking about it, but she hadn't played for years. Went to her old coach, Steve Bandura, from Marian Anderson Rec Center, started practicing, then tried out this summer, and now she's a top contender.
Yeah, and it's, you know, this is obviously an uphill battle for a new league, new league. And, of course, competing with softball, which has, you know, a much deeper track record of, you know, producing well-known athletes, at least women athletes, than baseball. But when you think about women's baseball, she might be the most famous women's baseball player mm-hmm. still today, because her exploits at the Little League World Series back in 2014 were so spectacular. Yeah. So she has the chance to be the face of this effort to establish a women's baseball league, yeah. which is amazing to think about since, you know, her fame dates back, you know, about a decade at this yeah. point. But she was such a star. And
she's still so young.
She's still so young.
Yes.
And the fact that, you know, it wasn't just that she was a great pitcher in Little League. It was her poise.
Yes.
You know, her affability, her mm-hmm. ability in front of the camera. Like, she has that real star quality.
She really does.
That, you know, that we don't have a lot of other exemplars of that in the women's baseball space.
No.
A lot of great women's softball players, but she has a chance to sort of be the face of this, and hats off to her. You know, she was one of the great sports stories in my time in Philadelphia. Yeah. Still is.
Love it. Love it. And they're going to have a watch party tonight in Marian Anderson Rec Center for her.
I'd be drafting her number one.
I know. I hope she does go number one.
Yeah, she could break the heat.
I know, that's right. I'm all looking right. forward to Monet Dancing.
We're bringing the heat on work culture coming up on Studio 2. Don't go anywhere. We want your horror stories. Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Work is a four-letter word. That's both a statement of fact and, at times, for some people, a statement of feeling. Sometimes work can suck. Today, we're going to talk about the things in work culture that bug us and how to fix them. You know, performance reviews, meetings, reply all emails, all of that and more is on the table.
5 years ago, the pandemic totally scrambled work culture. But things are getting back to a new normal. Companies are forcing workers back into the office. Performance reviews no longer graded on a curve. And new variables like AI and Gen Z workers have entered the chat.
So today we want to hear from you, folks on the road, at home, elsewhere. What's been driving you nuts at work these days? And what can your boss or bosses do better? The number to participate is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, put your comments. We want to hear those stories. Put them in the live chat.
And we've got a couple great guests with us today mm-hmm. to answer your questions and guide this whole conversation. Lauren DiNincenzo is a professor at Drexel's LeBeau College of Business. Lauren, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, it's fun to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Max Reed is author of the popular Substack, Max Reads, and a writer for the New York Times advice column, Work Friend. Hi, friend. Hi, Max. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And so we're all back in the office, a lot of us, most of the time at this point, and we're not as nice as we may have been a few years
Speak
ago.
For yourself.
And so I wanted to sort of set the scene and for each of you to just kind of tell me what's been bubbling up in your sphere as far as workplace culture. What has been nagging folks? Lauren, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the return to office. You know, after the pandemic, people got used to working at home after a little bit of a bumpy start. But now being forced to get back in there, it's disrupted routines. It's hurt the productivity for a lot of folks. You know, they didn't have the flexibility that they learned to get used to in those years post-pandemic. Mm.
So the change, they're not liking it. So they're just overall having to come back in the office is making a lot of folks a little bit upset. So Max, your thoughts, what's been bubbling up in your inbox as far as workplace culture?
Well, definitely the return to office. I get, you know, I'm looking back through the last few months of emails we've gotten. There's a lot of requests for advice on how to convince someone's boss not to force them back into the office. The other thing we're seeing a lot of is AI related questions
yes.
from a bunch of different angles. You know, too many people in my office are using AI without actually reading my emails. My boss is asking us to use AI. I think this recruiter or this person who's doing hiring is using AI. That's like a whole new frontier of workplace etiquette, workplace law that is still being established.
Okay, so I want to bring in, because you talked about technology. Mm-hmm. Actually, we have a voicemail from someone
yes.
who has a technology question. It's not quite... on the technological continuum, it's not quite to AI. In fact, it's mm-hmm. several steps before that. But let's play this voicemail, I believe, from Mac in Philadelphia. Let's hear Mac's workplace dilemma.
Hi, my name is Mac. I live in Philadelphia. Something I'm concerned about in the workplace is just how to speak kindly with older folks who seem to not want to learn how to use the computer better. Maybe this seems like a rude ask, but I just want to be able to speak kindly with older folks, try to help them get more proficient at things like Microsoft Office. But sometimes it feels like they, you know, don't want to get invested in technologies.
Okay, so we can generalize a bit. Obviously, Microsoft Office is a technology that's been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. But the basic friction here, Max, is that it seems like Max's coworkers just aren't interested in being on the same technological page as Mac. And it is hard sometimes to get work done with people who don't want to engage in technology at all. So how do we try to negotiate this conflict, Max? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I love a question that has this sort of abstract, generalizable situation that feels very much like if you were hearing it over a beer, there would be a really specific person who would maybe be named and involved in there. You know, it's funny, we're talking about new stuff that's bubbling up. It's something that we still see. I would say the majority of our questions are about difficult coworkers. Yeah. It's really hard to be in an office 40 hours a week with somebody who you just don't get along with. Mm-hmm. And there's a host of sort of basic social things that we all can and should do, you know, ways to try and convince people to do things. But at the end of the day, your job is to do your job. And if teaching a coworker to use Microsoft Office is not part of your job description, and it's taking up a significant amount of your time or your, and you know, your psychic energy because of how difficult it is, you need to alert your manager or your boss that you are now devoting too much extra energy. It's the kind of thing that feels a little like this should be the manager's problem or the supervisor's problem and not Mac's problem.
Yeah, that's
now,
a fair point.
So maybe this older person in the office is the manager or supervisor, in which case I'm not quite sure what to do.
Yeah.
But that's where I would say.
Yeah, that's a good place to start.
I love that. So let's bring in a caller. We have Bethany from Coatesville on the line. Bethany, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, so my comment is I work for a nonprofit that deals with individuals who are specifically unhoused or trying to access resources. Biggest thing we face is there's not enough time in the day, or all of the data entry that we have to do after we're meeting with people or helping them just takes up so much time. And so I would love to see if there are ways that our directors can try to either find more time, which often means finding more money, or trying to be able to consolidate the sheer number of just data that we have to record on a daily basis.
Mm, that's a great question. Can I kick that to you, Lauren? Because look, back in, I don't know, it's probably the 30s, the economists were telling us we're only going to have to work 15 hours a week.
Now it's
because technology was going to make everything so efficient. And that really hasn't played out for a lot of people in a lot of jobs. So talk about ways that we can responsibly make things more efficient so we feel like we have more time to do the real work and not just do data entry.
Yeah, well, I'll say that the caller's not alone, that I hear this all the time. I just don't have enough time to do what I need. There just aren't enough time hours in the day. And this is where I think something like AI can come into play, right? When we have repeatable tasks, when we have things that are redundant, there are things that we can do to become more efficient. Now, you might say, oh, my goodness, AI, I don't know really how to use it. I'm not sure how that can work here. We don't have to become experts and know how the system works under the cover. But there are ways that we could maybe ask some really specific questions about if there is something around data entry, what are the ways that I can use AI to help automate that process a bit more? And we're finding a lot more efficiencies around that. Other things are just to reach out. You don't have to suffer alone. You have other colleagues who are probably dealing with similar issues. And maybe there are some times where, hey, I can pick up a little bit of the slack here and you can help out someone else down the road. So we can almost create this buddy system where we can help one another out and we don't have to go at it alone.
Yeah. Buggy on YouTube says, OMG, we're being asked to use AI to answer questions while we're on calls. And the amount we use the AI tool is being measured, which I just feel like is ridiculous. So they're actually being forced to use AI. And so, Max, I remember coming into my first newsroom. about 15 years ago. And the big new technology everybody had to adopt was using social media. Like, you had to get on it. And if you didn't get on it, like, it was going to hurt your job. And now, of course, all journalists kind of use social media for the most part. Just your thoughts on how, you know, when a new technology is sort of pushed on you, like, should you just kind of adopt it? Like, what should be your point of view when it's sort of being shoved onto you? Like, how do you communicate that?
Yeah, I mean, we're in the midst of a huge AI bubble, which means that a lot of managers in particular even are themselves even under pressure from the people above them to get their AI usage up so that on earnings calls or whatever they can say, we're using AI this more so the stock price can go up a little bit. And I think it's really hard to swim against the tide for that, frankly, especially at a really large company. And at some point, this is one of those things you just got to find a way to make your boss happy. The problem is, in a lot of these instances, there are jobs or things you are doing for which AI truly is not the best solution. Yeah. And I think the sort of two-part answer I would give is, in some cases, I think it's worth playing around with AI and seeing if there's a way that it can make your job more efficient, or finding things it can do that can at least allow you to sort of check the box for your manager. And the other thing is, I think if you can present to a manager a sort of coherent case against using it, and especially if you can gather your other coworkers together to present that as a unified front, you can make a pretty decent case to exempt yourself from whatever kind of regulations they're trying to force on you. You know, it's easy for a manager to say no to one employee, but if you can get a lot of them in a room together and you have a piece of paper that says this sucks, I think you can make a lot of headway.
By the way, note from our producer, Hazel, says MIT recently did a study on all this that showed that only 5% of companies are really seeing major returns on their AI push. So it's early days. Obviously, folks hope that number will go up. But Max brings up the idea that it could be performative for companies because they want to impress folks on the outside. And that's going to be difficult for folks to negotiate.
Yeah.
Should we bring in another caller now?
We should. By the way, can we remind you quickly of the question?
Sure.
What's been driving you nuts at work these days, and what can your boss do better? Again, the number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Go right ahead. Bring in the caller.
Oh, yeah. We got Laura from Yardley on the line. I actually think Laura wants to like respond to a prior dilemma we had. This should be interesting. Okay, Laura from Yardley, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I just wanted to reply to Mac. I really appreciate that she wants to be kind and compassionate to the older folks that don't want to learn this stuff, and she asked how she can do that. One thing I remind myself is that, you know, we got by for thousands of years without this technology, and so the older folks had systems that worked. So maybe they're not wrong if they just don't have the energy to learn a new thing. So, yeah. You know, I might help here and there, but I also agree with your host that said that ultimately, if it's taking up too much time, it is something for the management to handle. But I just remind myself that, you know, we managed just fine for thousands of years, for about 150 years of modern business. So I can afford to be a little bit patient with the older generation.
Aww, I like that Laura conversation between the callers there.
Love that. Laura from Yardley. Thank you so much. One of the things that our producers told us, Lauren, is that you had been hearing people being a little less civil than in past. Tell us how that has been showing itself in the workplace, this incivility.
Yeah, I think it's a big trend that we're seeing. And recently I was at a conference and I heard Johnny Taylor, who's the president of SHRM, talk on the top three issues that organizations, HR professionals are facing. And one of them was this issue of incivility. And, you know, oftentimes we'd hear that people are leaving an office place because they don't like their manager or they don't like the company. But more we're seeing that people are leaving because they're having trouble with their peers. There's a lot more fighting that's happening in the workplace. And there was a really interesting statistic that he brought up that for every act of incivility, people lose about 37 minutes of productivity. So it takes you about 37 minutes just to recover from that act of incivility. So if you imagine if we're seeing rates rise, you can just multiply that by the amount of time that's being wasted in recovery, and then the effect that you're seeing on mental health and satisfaction and just lower overall engagement in the workplace.
And when you say being the act of incivility, is that someone just being rude, mean? What is that?
Great question. So it can be a range of things, and what we all individually see as an act of incivility can differ. It could be rudeness, it could be microaggressions, just making a small side comment. Or it could be larger things. We're seeing workplace violence move up as well.
Monica wrote in and said, HR here, one of my top issues that folks don't know how to leave people alone. Yes, collaborate, but it still amazes me when people complain about coworkers. She doesn't like me. He's mean. Susan, just because they don't want to talk to you for 15 minutes daily does not mean they don't like you. Okay. Like you said, there's a range in terms of what people consider to be not civil. But this this goes to a big question, a big overarching question, Max, that I have about workplace culture, which is basically how close should you be to your coworkers? How much, what really is the social contract with coworkers? Is it we know things about our lives? Is it we share important milestones with each other? Is it we know nothing about each other? It's going to be a little bit different for everyone, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people just want a baseline or a default for how close they should be to their colleagues. Max, what's your advice?
The way I see it is you owe your coworkers three basic things. You owe them solidarity, you know, which is to say, like, they're on your side against management when it counts. You owe them your job. You got to do your job so that they can do their jobs, and you got to pull your weight. And you owe them the same kind of politeness and kindness that you owe any other human being on the planet. And I think as long as you're doing that, you don't need to know where they're from, where they live, what kind of car they drive, what their kids are like. As long as you can be there doing your job, offering them support, and not being a jerk, I think that's the baseline. But of course, you're working with them every day. You're going to make some friends. You're going to make friends. You're going to make people who are closer than other people. But I think a lot of what we talk about when we say, you know, oh, he's mean to me, or he's, you know, he's not, he's, I wish that we were closer, or whatever, it's maybe more that person isn't offering to you, you know, the sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Feeling that you're looking for.
Right. Some people crave connection in any setting that they're in, and especially office, because I do feel like, just the way modern society is, it's hard to connect with people. There aren't lots of places that we like physically share with each other. The workplace might be one of them.
And you're there for a lot of hours.
I do think some people are seeking that out. But I think what I'm hearing from you, Max, is that it's fair to say to someone like, I know you seek that out here, but I'm not obligated to give that.
I have a quick follow-up, because Avi and I were talking before the show. Yeah. We have very different energies that we give off. And so to piggyback on Avi's, you know, query there, how do you sort of draw boundaries? Because a lot of times you have coworkers that will ask you very personal questions at work. So how do you sort of like not answer or draw that boundary to say that's inappropriate?
I mean, if I knew, I think I'd be a much more popular person, I have to say. It's hard. I mean, look, I think that all of us practice as adults in our lives in general, being able to say, I'm not going to answer that in whatever polite way you can come up with, and saying, I'm really busy right now. Can we talk later? You know, I can't possibly make it to your drinks or your wedding, or your dinner. I'm just so, you know, like I can't make it work right now. You know, I don't know that everybody, you always have to be as brutally honest as would necessarily, you know, as might necessarily be true. But I think that being early and firm with those boundaries is a good way of demonstrating to people that you're not instead of opening yourself up and then closing it off, you've just set a boundary early on, and you're going to do your job, and you're going to be there for people in the workplace, and you're going to get everything done and go home at night, and they shouldn't be offended, and you just go in every day and you do that.
Interesting email from Jacob. I want to read this one. It's a little long, but it's interesting. I was working from home full time during the pandemic. Then they called us back in. Now we're 2 days in, 3 days out, which is okay. But I have a 45-minute commute, have to make lunch, go to bed earlier, do my laundry. It's about 2 hours and 45 minutes of my time. And you do that 5 days a week. You're almost working two more shifts in a week. Like, what about compensation for all that travel when you were able to be doing your job just perfectly fine from home? So, Lauren, you said in the beginning, there is clearly a trend toward calling people back. And a lot of workers are wondering why. Like, why do my bosses feel compelled to call me back when I thought I was getting it done pretty well at home. So what's behind the trend? And will we see at some point workers exert some leverage to say, I would rather work at the place that doesn't make me do this? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And there's a lot to unpack behind it. I think, yeah. You know, there's reasons that are outside of your control. We saw in real estate, there were a lot of office buildings that were left unutilized.
Yep.
And so there's a big call. Hey, if we're paying for this space, we want you to be there.
Yeah. As a worker, that's not going to be very convincing to me.
Not at all, yes. Right? So, but that's one, right? That's one of those external pressures. The other thing is that we've been comfortable in the office, right? That's how, to the previous caller, that's kind of how we've done work for the longest time. And so people just feel like that's the thing that we should be doing. But if we can demonstrate our productivity at home, right? A lot of the times, if I don't see you, do I trust that you're working and not just going on a Target run?
The managers
want to
see you, yeah.
Right? if I just check in you with you on Teams or Zoom or whatever mm-hmm. you're using, are you going to be there? So a lot of it, for me, boils down to developing trust, right? And trust starts with, do I like you and do you know what you're doing? So we can do that in a lot of ways to build that relationship, build that trust, both through just being approachable, being supportive, but being respectful in our conversations, and doing that time and time again can build that trust. And then we often see that managers are a little bit more forgiving mm-hmm. or okay with, all right, I trust that you're doing the work that you're supposed to.
I feel like there might be a disconnect, maybe I'm wrong, between how efficient and effective people working from home feel they are and how effective and efficient their managers feel they are, or the company higher-ups. Maybe it's not their direct reports or whatever, but is there a disconnect there? Because I hear a lot of people say, I was doing fine, I was doing great. And then I read some stuff from the 30,000-foot view of people being like, our efficiency dropped 15% or by this
measure. People
are
not responsive.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Is there a disconnect, or I don't know?
Absolutely. I think that this is one of the biggest problems, and it boils down to communication.
Yeah.
Often there's what employees expect and what managers think, there's a disconnect. There was a really interesting study done where they asked employees, what motivates you the most? And then they asked their managers the same question, what motivates your employees? The number one response for employees was feeling appreciated by management. The managers said that the number one thing that motivates their employees is compensation.
Mm. Wow.
Now, those are two very, very different motivational. Yep.
By the way, Kate from New Jersey says, manager and worker are two types of people. Managers love to boss around and control. Workers like to be left alone. My suggestion is managers should have meetings among each other and manage themselves and leave your workers alone.
Whoa.
Thank you so much, Kate from New Jersey.
Okay. I guess time to bring in another caller.
Yes.
This is Tony from Media. Hey, Tony, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Hi, how you doing? I have 40 employees, and one of my biggest problems is just the controlling tone of voice in the way that employees will react, or they'll react with each other. And it's hard to de-escalate that. So that's my comment.
Okay. Follow-up, Tony, if you're still there. Like, but people are being mean with each other? They're yelling at each other?
No, but just a tone of voice is very difficult to control for some people. You know, they become reactive and, it's difficult to deal with the situation. Even, people misunderstand what's being communicated to them.
Mm.
So are they loud or is it like a harsh tone? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Like a harsh tone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Tone. So, Max, your reaction to Tony's call, kind of having trouble with the way, I guess, employees are talking with each other, talking to management, and like really not sure what to do. We're coming up on a break, but maybe in about a minute here, you could wrap this one up.
Yeah, I mean, that to me sounds like a really basic communications issue. And I would be interested to hear how Tony's employees experience the conversations they're having and their reactions. That, it's one thing to say, oh, like, why can't they be less emotional about these when we don't know precisely what's being said to the employees? I think if I was in a position to be advising Tony, I'd suggest finding somebody in his group of employees who he feels like he could communicate well with, and using them as a person to act as a sounding board, but maybe also as somebody who can communicate with the employees employees in a way that isn't going to immediately create the kind of labor management conflict that seems to be giving him stress.
Almost like a liaison.
Wow.
Yeah,
that makes actually like really good
union,
advice.
Or just like maybe a union and like a, you know, a union leader. I don't know, something like that.
Because sometimes the owner of the company isn't the best person to communicate that down to the employees.
I would think so.
Yeah.
All right. So we're coming up on a break here. Mm-hmm. Great comment from MJ, who just says, so glad I'm retired.
Uh-huh.
Salute to you, MJ.
And we're all working.
If you want to come
we're
in,
all working,
if you want to call in and brag that you're retired, I actually, I'm fine with that. I enjoy that energy. But we are asking you this hour, you know, kind of what's bugging you at work? What's been driving you nuts at work these days? What can your boss do better? We have not talked about meetings yet.
No.
We have to get into that on the other side of this break.
Or all the emails.
Emails, performance reviews.
So many things on the list.
All right. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. The email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Studio 2. Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We've been talking about ways to make the workplace better and what gets in the way. Things like unproductive meetings, pointless performance reviews. We're talking about that now. Toxic behavior from bosses and colleagues and the latest push to get everybody to adopt AI. And with us in studio is Lauren DiNincenzo, professor of management at Drexel's LeBeau College of Business. We also have by Zoom Max Reed, who writes the New York Times Work Friend column.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere. What's been driving you nuts at work these days? What can your boss do better? 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Want to read this comment from E, who says, I don't mind going into work if need be, but I do the exact same thing. Hop on Zoom calls all day because we're on a sprawling campus, and I lose an hour and 15 each way in commute, breaking my flow state because SEPTA is broken. Okay, SEPTA issues aside, we've done those shows, E. But I do feel like during the pandemic, something about meeting culture kind of got sent into overdrive, and maybe we need to figure out how to get to a new neutral here. With how many meetings and what meetings should be about. So Lauren, give us the state of meeting culture and like what maybe needs to be adjusted there.
Oh, absolutely. I think our knee jerk is always, well, let's make it a meeting. Let's talk about it. And it becomes, we have far too many. There's about 55 million meetings going on every week. And that is way too much. So we need to think, you know, does this need to be a meeting should be our first question, and who needs to be there?
What's your criteria for that?
Yeah, what's the rule of thumb?
So we need to have clear agendas, right? We need to know what it is we're trying to accomplish in the meeting. Is it a meeting where we're just brainstorming ideas and we're trying to come up with something new? Or are we really trying to solve a problem? So who do we need there? So a good rule of thumb is if that person doesn't have any role, if they're likely not going to offer any advice, then leave them off of the meeting. Now, some people will say, well, I don't want to leave anybody out. So I invite them. You know, reach out to that person and say, hey, you're optional here, and give that person the opportunity. But I've worked with a number of companies, too, who say I've stopped accepting meeting invites if there is no agenda attached to it. So that's something that's really important and can help set the stage for what we're trying to accomplish.
And Max, I wanted to address that comment that Avi read, because I think it's, why are we coming to the office if we're going to meet on Zoom or Teams? Like, I've seen people in their individual cubicles in the same pod, all on the same meeting with headphones on versus meeting in person. Like, you know, should we be actually meeting, having FaceTime versus being on these virtual platforms? Like, how should we determine what to do, and how do you communicate that to
I think you're absolutely right. it seems like a waste of everybody's time for everybody to just go sit in a cubicle, get on the same Zoom call when they could all just be at home and save a couple hours out of their commute. You know, I think this is a example of return to work policies that haven't really clearly communicated what the point of returning to work is. So much of these problems that we've already been talking about come down to communication from management. And if management isn't setting, sort of in a broader sense, an agenda, a meta agenda for what return to work means, such as we're going to have these meetings all together in the conference room, seeing each other's faces, then you're going to end up with these kind of sci-fi scenarios of like individualized remote work from where everybody's next to each other. Yeah. And I think that so long as managers themselves have a clear idea of what return to work means to them, besides just the idea that from their, you know, glass-walled office, they can see all of their employees and feel like they're still in charge, then we're going to have problems like this.
Yeah.
Let's bring in another caller on line three here, Madison from Brewery Town. A lot of people are talking about return to work, which you guys predicted at the top of the show, right?
Yep, this is
what keeps popping up. I think Madison's on that topic as well. Hey, Madison, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, yeah. So sorry, I don't want to beat a dead horse.
No, go ahead.
Beat it, Madison.
I could go on and on and on, but if I'm going to narrow it down to be more specific with return to office, there's a lack of transparency around just the general rules and the flexibility, especially now as we are entering flu season. As I'm sure you guys know, this is expected to be an unprecedented flu season for us. And when asked, hey, can I, you know, I'm not feeling well, could I just take the day to work from home so I don't, you know, spread further germs to all of my coworkers? There's a lot of hesitation and answers from our bosses about what we should do. And they generally are like, well, I guess you're just going to have to put in PTO, even though you can work perfectly fine. You're not, you know, completely incapacitated, but you're now wasting time.
Wait, real quick follow-up, Madison. Just in your opinion, why do you think your bosses react that way? Maybe they feel like it's a fairness thing, like I can't give it to one person and not another. Maybe they feel like they're getting pressure from above them. Or maybe you don't know, but do you think you have a sense of why they feel like uneasy granting those requests?
Yeah, my sense is that it has a lot to do with HR and the fact that they aren't being extremely clear with them on what the policy is. And I think they receive a lot of pressure from, you know, C-suite executives and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Interesting call from Madison and Brewery Town.
Any thoughts, Lauren, on that? I mean, because the policies are kind of squishy and everything's been changing since people came back to the office.
Yeah, and I think that we do as employers need to just approach things with more flexibility. And obviously, if people are starting to take advantage of it, right, that's when we start to have more rules and regulations because now we need to put some type of cap on it. But offering that level of discretion, and I think it goes to this concept of swift trust, right? Right away, I'm just going to offer you trust, and I'm going to see what you're going to do with it. And I think employees appreciate that, and given the opportunity, all right, let me take that sick day, and if you don't abuse it, you've earned my trust, right? And we can keep moving forward like that. But a lot of this lack of clarity, I think, boils back to what I was talking about before when it comes to just building trust among employers and employees.
Yeah.
Jill on YouTube says, I have to come into the office 3 days a week to quote unquote collaborate. The main people I have to collab with aren't there. Two of the days I am. We have to do team calls anyways. It's silly, but hey, office culture, right? And I do feel like there is something incumbent upon managers and companies to like prove to the employer that this is necessary, that there's actually benefit to them being in the office. And I don't know how you do that. That's outside of my wheelhouse. But I just feel like from these comments, a lot of people aren't buying it. They're not buying that there's a benefit. And clearly, we talked about this disconnect earlier. But anyways, maybe we have beaten the dead horse on that.
And by the way, we teased this before the break and at the top of the show. We got to talk about performance reviews.
We have to.
Because every year, some companies make you go through the process. Some folks don't understand why. Lauren, can you just lay out why companies do this? And does it do anything for you at work? Like, I mean, break it down for us. What's it supposed to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, performance review, we're supposed to be able to evaluate how people are performing. But when you think about the way that they're typically set up, it's once a year, right? And so if I'm being evaluated now based on something I did back in February, that's not doing me any good. And, yep. and chances are I've been making the same mistake over and over and over again. Mm. So I think one of the biggest issues with performance reviews is they come so infrequently that it's really hard to gauge, right? You have recency effects. I'm going to be heavily influenced by what I just did in my most recent review. I think we need to kind of flip the script a little bit and do these things more frequently. And rather than having the big time of year where you do it, have smaller check-ins, right? I can call you. I can connect. 10 minutes. How are things going? After a project, connect. How are things going? And we're going to see a lot more productivity and people are going to be happier and be able to adjust more frequently instead of just that one major event.
Do you care about qualitative versus quantitative when it comes to performance reviews? Because a lot of people do like the 5-point system. I got a 3.5. I got a 3.2. And some people, it seems like, lean away from that. Do you care at all? It just has to be. But or do you think we can do good versions of each of those?
I think there's good and bad in both.
Yeah.
I think it's the frequency of what comes down to me,
yeah.
right? I think a lot of people kind of push, well, this person did better. So if I'm on a one to five scale and they got a 4 last time, well, then they must be a 5. But then where do you go after that?
Right.
So it's hard to make those adjustments.
Okay. By the way, we got a couple callers on the line. I want to bring in Oscar from South Philly. He's on
South
the line.
South Philly!
Oscar, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey, gang. So I work at a busy nonprofit. Everything's a priority except for one-on-ones. I never get a chance to meet with my boss. And I've noticed lately that he's forgetting things we've discussed in real time. And I'm having to backtrack to say, no, we agreed to this, even though I might not have an email proof of it. And I feel like I'm being distrusted. It's extra work for me to justify things we agreed upon. So I'm wondering if you have suggestions for systems or processes to avoid this, to mitigate this.
Yeah. Max, your take on this. It sounds, I don't know, CYA emails? I don't know. You give your thoughts on this.
I mean, that's what
Max.
I was going to say. Oscar, it sounds like a little bit like you already know what the best thing to do, which is start making, you know, email chains or paper chains, paper trails of the agreements that you've made, which means like if you have a quick conversation with him and there's nothing written down about what he's agreed to, the minute you get back to your desk, write down an email. I just want to confirm with you based on what we just talked about. You know, here's the date we talked about. Here's the dollar sum we talked about, whatever it is that you guys are agreeing on. At the very least, you might be able to identify how quickly he's forgetting these things, but also you can ensure that you have a record so you don't feel quite so crazy when you're coming back in 2 weeks and wondering.
All right, another caller now. Mike from the Lehigh Valley
Mike.
Line 6. Hope everything's good in the Lehigh Valley, Mike. What's your question or comment?
Thanks. Public radio for the win. Thank you, guys. my issue is about sort of transparency and feedback. So the immediacy of feedback, I absolutely agree. We need to have our sessions more often to talk with people about how they're doing. But I've been a recipient of this kind of blinded, de-identified feedback, and then also kind of a side party to it, where you don't know what you've done wrong because the person who thought you did wrong, you know, has their confidentiality protected by your manager, by HR. I'm wondering if you guys have suggestions on how to open that discussion up without silencing folks from providing
that
feedback.
That is so tricky.
Thank you.
Such a good question from Mike. But because I can see why anonymity is important for workers to feel comfortable like bringing a complaint, but then if the other person's like, I don't know what I did or who I did it to, they don't even know what to change. I mean, Lauren, this seems really tricky. I don't know if there's an easy answer here.
Yeah, there's really not. I mean, it's hard to accept feedback where we don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And oftentimes feedback is given as a problem rather than framed as here's a potential solution, right? And so when they're just framed as a problem and we don't know where it's coming from, it's harder to accept that. We're more likely to accept negative feedback when we trust the person where it's coming from. And so when that's closed off, it's much harder. So that's a tricky situation because there are times where you want to protect confidentiality. But I think having more open, honest conversations, if we can do those more frequently, if we can reach out to others and try to connect some of those dots. But it is a tricky situation.
And Max, quick follow up on that topic. I mean, I had an incident where someone didn't tell me that they had an issue with me. They went to HR instead, and that's how it was communicated to me. So I wonder, like, when should you just have a conversation with a colleague or a manager versus bringing in the manager or HR? Like, how do you sort of gauge whether or not this is the type of thing you can just have a one-on-one conversation and just give that kind of feedback.
Yeah, I mean, it varies between the people, and I don't think there's a hard and fast rule, but I think most people can, like our immediate judge of whether or not you can have an in-person conversation, we could sort of ratchet that up a little bit. But I think that we, in workplace situations, should be a lot more comfortable with open and honest and direct communication. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about the pandemic, and I'm not sure I want to lay all this at the feet of the pandemic, but it feels like people are often quite afraid of having those kinds of direct conversations. When in fact, I think there's more room to have them than there often is, provided that you're approaching them in a, you know, like in the spirit of honest, productive feedback and conversation rather than, you know, an immediate jump to aggression. That doesn't to say that, you know, every conversation can or should be had in that kind of way. But I tend to think that you will get more immediate solutions to the problems if you're able to articulate directly to the person who you're having trouble with what's going on and what kinds of solutions you think you guys can work on together.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to say bye to you before I bring on our final caller, who I think is going to give us a perfect coda. So stand by for that. Thank you, Max Reed, author of the popular Substack Max Reads and writer for the New York Times advice column Work Friend. Max, thanks so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And Lauren DiNincenzo is a professor who studies teams and leaderships at Drexel. And thank you so much, Lauren, for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And bringing us home now is Linda from South Jersey. Got to keep it real quick, Linda. Linda, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, guys. Love your show. My comment is this. I'm on my second career, and I find in both of my full careers that I've had that people are generally unhappy on their job. I am not saying that they don't have legitimate complaints, but my thought, every time I encounter people like that is leave. Find something that makes you happy, because I believe a person that is miserable on their job, what are they like in their homes? Because they carry that home and it's not healthy.
Yep. All right. So this is the perfect time now to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Hit it.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left.
Oh, that was so poetic. Yes. Take this job and shove it by Johnny Paycheck from 1977. Who's the DJ of the day?
Yes. It went to number one. Let's say thank you to Scott B. for choosing that song and for being our DJ of the day. Thank you so much. That's the perfect way to end the show. And thank you, by the way, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And let me just say, we like our jobs, okay?
I'm not shoving this job. Okay. I like this job.
I'm Avi Wolf with Eric. We'll talk to you next week.
If I had the guts to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working.